Okay. Now, we finished last talk. We mentioned a few of the 32 major signs of a Buddha, which indicate great attainments, a great person, that due to the attainments he achieved on the path. Some of the signs were 1,000 spoked wheels on the palms and soles, smooth soles, fingers and toes connected with a like a web of white light, so on. A few others are the Buddha's skin is very smooth and has no wrinkles and is a sign of having been extremely generous, giving food and drink, and not just giving the sort of things which were secondary or which one doesn't like so much. They are, oh, I don't really like, I'll make offering of this, but offering one's favorite foods, right, to others. And again, the rounded tops of his hands and feet and shoulders, back of the neck, sort of very full and round, is a sign of having been similarly very generous in giving things such as good quality clothes, and materials for shelter, and so on. Long finger and toenails is a sign of being very kind in saving the lives of many animals. I'm not sure. Maybe the toenails represent the claws of animals or something, but anyway, that's a sign of that activity. And so on, through the other 32 physical signs, they all indicate perfect ways of practicing on the path to achieve Buddhahood, accumulation of great merit or positive energy. Then the Buddha's speech has a list of 60 special qualities of the Buddha's, the sound of the Buddha's speech and what he says, and again, just a few of those 60. When the Buddha talks, it's extremely productive. It's likened to the rain which softens the earth and makes the growth of plants and crops and so on possible. Then, when the Buddha's speech is heard, it touches each individual according to their personal dispositions and interests and enables the germination, the cultivation of merit in those, and it increases the power of merit that they've already created. So this is the productive quality of Buddha's speech. It's said to be very smooth, just as the touch of very fine, divine robes, silk and so on, pleases the body. Then when people hear that, just the tone of the Buddha's speech, it gives great mental delight. It's very direct, in that whenever the Buddha teaches, it gives direct meaning of the two truths, conventional reality and ultimate reality. The Buddha's speech always includes indication or teaching of dependent arising and the 37 aids to enlightenment and so on. So there's no words that the Buddha utters that don't indicate aspects of the path. Last night I took a book out of the library written by a French he was a Frenchman who was involved in making films, who wasn't a Buddhist, but he knew quite a lot about Eastern religions and philosophy. And in the late 90s, he had several interviews with the Holy Siddhartha Lama. And so he produced these question and answer interviews with the Dalai Lama and interspersed it with a lot of his ideas. So I read the whole book last night, skipping over his ideas, and just reading the answers of the Dalai Lama. And really true. I mean, no matter what the journalist asked, you could see in His Holiness's answers, even though just one line or one word, they always conveyed some Dharma meaning. I guess one has to have had some further understanding of the Buddha's teachings, but certainly I could see in every sentence, every word, that, and even though the question asked some pretty silly questions, in fact, if anybody near my room last night, you would have heard me say, "That's a stupid question," talking to the book. But the answers, unbelievable. So clear. It's just pure Dharma. The Buddha's next quality of the Buddha's speech is sensible. Right? The Buddhas never speak in a ridiculous manner or with ungrammatical or broken language. It's always perfectly correct as the Buddha's speech arises from the direct non-conceptual realization of emptiness or of reality. It's unstained in that the Buddha's mind is unstained by the afflictions, the obscurations to liberation and their imprints. So, of course, speech comes from the mind, so as the mind is unstained, the speech is completely free of any stain of the afflictions. It's said to be sparkling clear, as it never uses words or expressions not commonly known, or using words or expressions just to impress others. It's harmonious to hear. Harmonious in that when you have people with extreme views, mistaken views, it brings their minds into tune with reality. It's invigorating when you hear the Buddha's speech. It gives one determination to abandon the uncontrollably recurring problems, which means the karmic ripening, by doing what the Buddha explains. It's without harm. It can't be outshone or faltered by extremist opponents in debate. And so on. There are 60 qualities which you'll find in the books. I took these from a book actually written by Geshe Nawandagi. Forget the name of it, but anyway, it'll be around. At the end of presenting these 60 qualities of the speech, Geshe Dagi, he said, we should compare these qualities of the Buddha's speech with our own speech and that of others to whom we may turn to for advice. No matter what we say, others seem to only misunderstand. We try to eliminate their confusion, but we only cause more. People might become upset by what we say, or they're hurt, even though we had no intention to offend or to hurt them. This happens so often. We're often at a loss for words. And when we try to communicate, then we become inarticulate, we contradict ourselves, or we speak with such poor grammar that others are displeased and dissatisfied. I mean, speech is so important. Yeah, it's the means of communication. And like all those 60 qualities which we didn't go through, they indicate the perfect speech of a Buddha. So the more we know about the qualities and the skills of a Buddha's speech, the more confident we will be in its ability to provide us with a safe and sound direction in life. Yeah? It is, in other words, it's the Dharma. It is the Dharma jewel, the Buddha's speech, and that is the perfect jewel of refuge. We will entrust ourselves wholeheartedly to learning from it, from the Dhamma. The more we ponder its inconceivable features, the deeper will be our faith, and consequently, the greater will be our spiritual progress. So, you know, this goes back to my introduction this morning of how our whole self-confidence, our self-esteem, our enthusiasm is dependent upon a sense of going in the right direction, of having a valid role model to live our life. And the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, these are the valid role models. The third aspect of the Buddha is the mind of a Buddha. I think I've listed the 10 powers, special qualities of the mind of a Buddha. So they're in the notes. You know, the Buddha's mind knows the profound relationship between karmic actions and their results. Whatever occurs, you know, to any sentient being, and this happens so often when Buddha's disciples asked him, you know, something strange happened, and they'll, where did this come from? They asked the Buddha. And he explained way back so many millions of years ago, millions of lifetimes ago, this and such a thing happened. So the Buddha knows the exact causes, and he knows what isn't the cause. So often we have all these ideas about, oh, you got this problem because this and that. Like last week, I had a cold, and people very kindly gave me medicine which helped, and then advice. Oh, it's probably the changing climate, the different temperature, food, whatever. I didn't know it's a virus. The cause of a cold is a virus. You don't meet the virus, you won't get a cold. But of course the other conditions may contribute to the degree. So I guess Buddha knew all about viruses as well. The Buddha's mind has the wisdom knowing the aspirations and the capability of his students and listeners. And so each of us has such a varied background and varied approach. The Buddha knows which words are appropriate for this person and which words are appropriate for that person. Just exactly knowing how to say it. I've mentioned a few examples of Lama Thupten Yeshu. You know, the answer was for her, not for you. That story I told last week. So it's true that specific individuals can comprehend from where they're coming. And that's, it's really true. I've, you know, traveling with Lama Yeshe, I remember on trains in India, long train journeys, and people are very friendly, they want to talk to you, and they ask you, and you know, conversations come up. And I just remember observing these Indian people, and they were talking to Lama Yeshe, and there was a group of businessmen. And so, you know, they're sharing stories, and Lama Yeshe became a businessman, and he spoke their language, and he communicated on business terms with them. Then other one was a farmer, you know, grew rice, wheat, and so on. And Lama Yeshe became a farmer, and he communicated with that person in terms which mutually understandable. It was so amazing to watch this ability to communicate, that this is the point of communicating, by being able to tune in to where a person's coming from. And it's not putting people down. It's very realistic, you know. It's being very honest and clear, and talking to people at their level. The next is knowing the oh, the interests of sentient beings and teaching accordingly, I've actually abbreviated in my main notes and the ones I handed out. So we'll leave this one at that. Knowing the levels of interest and capacity of sentient beings and teaching accordingly. And then the next group is knowing the paths that lead to the goals of the spiritual attainment. You know, we're talking the three types of practitioner, the hearer, solitary realizer, and bodhisattva. So the Buddha knows every detail of the path and teaches accordingly. The Buddha's mind knows the past rebirth states of every individual, knows the time of when a sentient being will die and their future rebirth, all of their rebirths up till they achieve enlightenment. So Buddha mind knows the past, present, and the future. Okay, so that's just a brief indication of the power of the mind of Buddha. Then the Dharma, well, the Dharma is all that we've heard. It is the graduated path, the Lam Rim, the five paths, paths of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, noble learning, the 10 bodhisattva grounds. It knows all of the paths, and in particular, the truth of cessation and the uninterrupted paths of seeing and meditation that are the true paths which bring to an end the mental afflictions. The good qualities of the Sangha, well, there are three levels of practitioner who gain realizations, the hearers, solitary realizers, and bodhisattvas. And their qualities are vast. There's presentations in the text like the bodhisattvas, as they, having directly realized emptiness, they enter the first ground, and then they progress through the 10 grounds, or bhumis, up until enlightenment. And there is explanation in the text of the incredible qualities that they achieve, like the exponential growth of power, of psychic powers and knowledge and so on, and that they develop on that path to Buddhahood. The next list in your notes is seven features that distinguish the Buddha Dharma and the Dharma or the teachings from other doctrines. So, of course, specifically, this is referring to the various beliefs and religious traditions that existed in India at the time of Buddha. So, the first is that the very definition of Buddhahood is the elimination of all mental faults, all negative karma, and the accumulation of all virtue. You know, the meaning of practicing Dharma is to practice virtue and abandon non-virtue. So that's the definition of Dharma practice, and the result, Buddhahood, is the perfection of that. Secondly, the Buddha's teaching, it brings happiness. There is nothing within the Buddha Dharma which brings unhappiness. And through generating a happy, peaceful mind, the path of Buddhism is easy to follow. It's smooth. In India at the time, you know, there were so many extreme ascetic practices of, you know, lying on spears and jumping off cliffs and all sorts of extreme asceticism, which still are practiced in India, which, according to the theory, were purification to eliminate the obstacles to whatever their goal was. There is no harshness involved in the Buddha's path. Everything is pleasing, and it's gentle, and you do achieve the result. Well, some of you, I see that there's a Nyungne coming up in a week or two. You know, that's hard. Not eating or drinking for a whole day. Well, it's a little bit hard, but it's those who have done Nyungne, you know how you feel the day after you break the fast. Incredibly pure and clean and blissful. And then you realize that the hunger and thirst of yesterday were minimal. And, of course, in the teachings of the Nyungne, it explains that this discomfort, hunger, thirst, and so on, is actually the ripening of negative karma, which would have ripened as suffering in the hells, hungry ghost realms, and so on. And we just experience some fatigue, thirst, hunger as humans. Amazing, the power of that type of purification. The teaching enables you to move against the flow of the four floods or the four rivers of samsara. So, you know, if you get, well, I don't know if you do know, but if a river is in flood and if you fall into it, the power of the water is so strong you cannot go against it. You have to, you're pushed along by the current. It's so powerful. So we, our lives are pushed, we're pushed through life by four floods. The floods of desire, the floods of wrong views, the flood of ignorance, and the flood of the ripening of karma. So we, our whole experience during life is, we can't stop it. We're caught up in these four floods. They're pushing us along. That's sort of on the causal side, and the resultant side of these four floods is the sufferings of birth, aging, sickness, and death. So, the teaching of Buddha enables you to hold firm against the flow of these floods, desire, ignorance, the afflictions, the ripening of wrong views, and the ripening of karma. The ripening of karma is scary. Everything. We think, oh yeah, I'm in control of my life. I have this amount of money. I have this education. I have this job. I have this circle of friends. Yeah, I'm in control, but we're not in control. Karma is in control of our lives. The ripening of our karma, usually from past lives, and we have no idea of what karmic seeds we brought with us. So, even though temporarily things go well, at any time, karmic disaster is ready to happen. We should know that. And what can we do about it? We can, by taking refuge and practicing Dharma, this Buddha has the exact antidote to those four floods. And this is unique to Buddhism. You know, it's not saying, Buddhism is best, all the rest are ridiculous. Think about it. Think about your own experience. And most other belief systems are just based on faith. Faith in God, faith in Brahma, faith in the scriptures. But that faith, remember, there are levels of faith. And simple faith is helpful, useful, but it can be lost. The fourth feature is that the teaching not only explains the problem, but it gives the solution to the problems, to remove the afflictions. The next, the Dharma does not deceive those seeking liberation. If you want to achieve liberation, the Dharma shows the method. Because liberation means freedom from karma and afflictions. This is the point. There can be deception. I mentioned that story from the Aryasanghata Sutra where the priest said you make sacrifice to the Deva and the Deva will take your son or look after your son. But that was deception. Sacrifices were made, the Deva was benefited, but the result didn't happen. And there's false teachings. I think it was the early 1970s. There was a self-proclaimed guru in America who took vast number, the Reverend Jones, I think it was his name, to Central America, and he said that the end of the world is coming. You must all kill yourselves. And many hundreds of people, families, mothers, fathers, children, were all given cyanide. They all died. And there were these incredible pictures in television of these families all huddled together. But they were promised that this will save you. Of course it didn't. Buddhist teachings don't do that. Okay, anyway. So there, I think you're getting the message that, which I find is very so real, that the teachings on the cause of suffering and the nature of suffering are easily understandable by each and every one of us. And they're logically correct, so if we put into practice the teachings, we will achieve the result. So the next point is in taking refuge, here are the three ideals, which I'm sure you've heard. The Buddha teaches refuge. We see the Buddha as our guide on the proper path. And so we listen to and we rely upon the Buddha from our heart. The Dharma is the actual refuge. Remember, meaning of refuge is seeking a safe direction. So taking refuge in the Dharma means practicing Dharma, and liberation and enlightenment are achieved. The Sangha are those who share the same goal as ourselves, and they have preceded us on the path. So that means that the Sangha, in a simple way, are those who know more than we know, and so they can teach us something, and they assist those who take refuge, and so we relate to the Sangha as our spiritual friends. All right. The next outline is the benefits of taking refuge. So, provided that our understanding of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha is very deep, and we have the heartfelt wish to practice Dhamma, then taking refuge is opening the door to the path to liberation and enlightenment. Having this mental attitude is the meaning of being a Buddhist. Taking refuge is a necessary foundation for taking and receiving further vows, the lay vows, the monks and nuns vows, bodhicitta vows, tantric vows, receiving tantric initiations and so on. Everything is preceded by taking refuge. If we don't have this foundation in our mind, then even if we attend a ceremony for giving vows or tantric empowerments, they won't stick. The power of the ceremony, the power of the initiation and so on, just goes straight through. There's nowhere in our mind for that power to take root in our mind. So we have to remember that and never abandon our deep refuge. I remember Geshe Sopa Rinpoche. He was a great lama who His Holiness asked to go to America long, long time ago, 40 years ago, more. And he learned English and he taught at universities in America. And some time ago, he gave an incredible discourse over many years on the Lum Rim Chenmo, the great Gaudiya Vaishnava Lama. It's been published by Wisdom, 5 volumes, which are fantastic. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, he attended as many of those teachings as he could. And I wasn't there, but I heard that the Lum Rim Chenmo is quite a big text. You know, it's this long, very thick, quite heavy. And throughout the teaching, or the teachings which went for so long, Rinpoche held the Lum Rim Chenmo to his crown, like just held this text there and listened. And we say, Lama Zopa Rinpoche himself is an unbelievable teacher and exponent of the Lum Rim. But when his guru was teaching the Lum Rim in English, then still, with the devotion to the Dharma represented by the text, holding it to the crown, it shows us how we should listen to Dharma teachings. You have to be concentrating. It gets heavy and heavy after an hour or so. So you're concentrating. So we sort of sit comfortably, no particular physical burden, and lamas are teaching Dharma, but our mind is elsewhere, you know. We're drifting. We're somewhere and we're looking at our watch and wish he'd hurry up. And it's not the right approach. So that was what the second benefit. The third benefit is that through taking refuge, it helps to purify and even eliminate karmic obstacles. Even the 5 heinous karmas can be weakened or overcome by sincere refuge. The virtue of taking refuge weakens and even destroys the ripening power of negative imprints, the rebirth result. So you know there are 4 opponent powers to put into practice to purify negative karma, and taking refuge is a major part of one of those powers. With refuge, the next point, you can easily accumulate vast amounts of positive karma. The virtue of taking refuge is immeasurable due to the immeasurable qualities of the 3 jewels. So it's so wonderful, like even here, the entrance to ABC Center, the gateway and Amitabha and the holy objects, the mantras. And it's so inspiring. People walk past and they just put their hands together with their heart and they bow, or they might come in and make prostration. That the merit, when the mind is sincere, is inconceivable. Of course, if we make offerings, prostration, hoping that we pass our examinations or that our business investment will succeed, are a little bit dubious. Our motivation. Just trying, the main thing is to try and align our mind with the 3 jewels. That is enough, and that is so powerful. And then the exams and the business investments will take care of themselves if we have entered them with a virtuous purpose. The next advantage, you cannot be bothered or overwhelmed by the harmful actions of humans or non-humans. It gives an aura of protection against black magic, spells, and so on. There are many stories of individuals at different times who took refuge and spirits were unable to harm them. Nobody can make a black magic spell to hurt them. You are impervious. You are totally protected by this aura of refuge. I mentioned earlier the time when I first took refuge in India. Well, I'm not sure. The day after that, I came down with malaria. I've never been so sick for 5 days. But I recovered. You know, I knew what it was, so I took the right medicine. But then I was in Bodh Gaya, and so I wanted to go down to Madras. And so I went to the railway station to buy a ticket, and I got a reserved seat with no trouble whatsoever. And if you know, if you've traveled in trains in India, you know how difficult it is to get a reserved seat and so on. So I put that down to having refuge. Well, then when I thought about it afterwards, and things went so well. Amazing how things unfolded. Now, I don't know, but I felt perhaps this is an indication of having refuge. And certainly my mood was very happy, very peaceful, even when I had malaria. So refuge in the mind enables you to achieve your virtuous goals effortlessly, and it gives you great confidence to practice Dharma strongly. And this is the method of taking the essence of your perfect human rebirth. Okay. So, those are the benefits. As you know, refuge is traditionally taken before a lama, a teacher, you know, a high monk or a nun. And there's a small ceremony where you verbally, you know, recite the words of taking refuge. You don't have to, but you can take the refuge vows. You know, in general, taking refuge, you promise to avoid the 10 non-virtuous actions. You know, 3 of body, 4 of speech, and 3 of mind. But on top of that, you can take vows for the remainder of this life, to not kill sentient beings, to not steal, to not lie, not commit sexual misconduct, not take intoxicants. So, during the ceremony, one doesn't have to take any of those vows. One can take 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. It's up to the individual. And at further refuge ceremonies, you can add to those vows as you feel capable of keeping them. The general advice after officially, you know, taking refuge in this way, there are 3 things that you should avoid doing. So, having taken refuge in the Buddha, you don't take refuge in worldly gods. But you can show respect. You know, if you're in a particular situation, in a society which demands, you know, acknowledgement or prostration to a worldly god, then to avoid any harms, you can just imagine Buddha there and you make prostration. And people think you're worshipping their god, but in your mind, you're worshipping Buddha. You know, things like that. We should respect others. We don't have to abide by their beliefs, but we should still respect that they are sentient beings. They are the objects of love and compassion. And they find something that gives their life meaning, even though we are aware that maybe temporary benefit, but not ultimate benefit. we don't antagonize them by putting them down or their practice. With refuge in Dharma, we should avoid harming, deliberately harming any sentient being. With refuge in Sangha, we should avoid the being influenced by misleading friends or other philosophies. And misleading friends, people who don't know what Buddhism is about, they think that we are wasting our lives, we're not enjoying our lives, and so they try to say, don't bother doing that, come to our party, etc. And so we should remain firm. We've taken refuge in the three jewels. From the Mahayana point of view, we've taken refuge until we achieve enlightenment. And the stronger we are in maintaining that mentally, the more powerful we are to resist these distracting influences in life. Specific commitments, what to do. We should respect all Buddha images as equal as the Buddha, even those which are poorly crafted or made from inferior materials. Doesn't matter whether it's gold Buddha or a wooden Buddha image, equally respect them as Buddha himself. This is what the images are for. They're not for worshipping the material. They're for worshipping what the material represents, Buddhahood. We should respect every single word or letter as if it were the Dharma jewel. One time, many years ago, we had a retreat centre in Australia, and there had been a lot of rain, and there were large puddles of water near the entrance to the meditation room. And somebody had been thinking of Lama Zopa Rinpoche coming, and instead of getting his feet wet, they'd spread newspaper over the water, the damp areas. And I was sort of ushering Lama Zopa Rinpoche into the meditation room, and he stopped. And these newspapers were all there at the entrance. He stopped, and then he walked completely around the edge, past the newspaper, and then into the gompa. So you don't even tread on any printed word, because that could be Dharma. The Dharma comes as printed words. So this shows the depth of awareness and mindfulness and having refuge. Of course, in Tibet, the People's Liberation Army paved the streets with Dharma texts and made the people walk on them. Nowhere else to walk. People were forced to walk on all the holy Dharma texts. So cynical. So cynical, this attitude of communism, of seeing Buddhism as primitive and incorrect and wrong, and forcing people knowingly to go against the very strength of their lives, their refuge. Of course, they didn't break refuge by being forced to walk on the Dharma text. It's only when you willingly, unknowingly do so. And the third is to respect even the Sangha's robes as though if they were the true Sangha. So often, Sangha's robes, which are worn out, instead of putting in the garbage, they're often put in high places, trees, so on. In Dharamsala, there was a tree, I used to call it the robe tree. Old monks and nuns' robes were all in this tree. So the tree was red, this old robe put up high. Okay, so you see, refuge is something which is in the mind all the time. And this is why it's protection. The general commitments, I'll just read them by recalling the good qualities, the three jewels. Each day, we should repeatedly generate our mind in Refuge of Buddha Dhamma Sangha, whenever we eat or drink, we should imagine the three jewels at our heart. So the first three sips of drink or food, we imagine we're offering to the three jewels at our heart. With compassion, we should encourage others to take refuge through our own example. It's not saying, you know, you must take refuge, but through your own sincere behavior, you inspire them. Remember, I said when I went to Bangkok and I met this American doctor who was looking, I was looking for a job, and he took me to temples. And in his prostration and offering incense to the statues, which for me was totally alien, still, I remember I was so impressed by his sincerity. And, you know, his calm state of mind in making offerings to the three jewels. And that probably was the seed which brought me into Buddhism. Definitely with him. See, you know, I respected him. He was incredibly intelligent, friendly, wise. And, as I think of it now, that could well have been the beginning of me meeting Buddhism and becoming a Buddhist and so on. In general, we should reflect upon the benefits of taking refuge and verbally, very simply, take refuge three times in the morning, three times at night. Whatever we do, you know, there's so many things in life, we're not sure what to do, how to do it, then by general, we can't go and ask the Lama, they're not around. No. Think of the qualities of three jewels, take refuge, and do, think what would please the Buddha. Is this action in harmony with refuge and three jewels? Then do it, and do it strongly, without hesitation, and without regret. Finally, we shouldn't abandon the three jewels, even at the cost of our life. Okay, so that's talking about refuge in general. And then the attainment of Buddhahood is the next topic. Before we go into that, is there any discussion that you wanted to have? Any questions? Or we talk about the attainment of Buddhahood? You should think of maybe anything. Any questions? Don't hesitate. Okay, so Buddhahood. The Sanskrit word kaya is translated as body. And that's a little bit confusing. Because the different kayas, or bodies, of Buddhahood. But only two refer to the physical body, the other two refer to the mind. Alex Berson tried to get around it by talking about the corpus, but you know, translating kaya as corpus, but corpus means body in Latin. So he didn't avoid the problem. So Buddhahood is presented as the four kayas or the four bodies, two physical, two mental. And so the Buddha's mind is presented as the nature body or the svabhavakaya, and the wisdom body or the wisdom dharma body, the dharmakaya. The nature body refers to the nature of the dharmakaya, you know, the underlying nature of the omniscient wisdom dharmakaya has these two aspects of purity. There's the innate purity, which is the empty nature or the void nature of a Buddhist mind that has been empty since beginningless time. So, the nature of our mind is empty of inherent existence. And so, this will become the nature body of the Buddhist mind. It's innate. It's inborn. In other words, it's our Buddha nature. The emptiness of our mind. It's not being inherently existing samsaric mind, confused mind, ignorant mind. It is empty of true existence. Which means that the samsara, or the ignorance in our mind, is superficial. Being superficial, it can be totally, that superficial ignorance can be totally removed, and that won't harm the mind. So then our mind will become a Buddhist mind, and the emptiness, the continuity of the emptiness of a samsaric mind becomes the emptiness of a Buddhist mind. That's the innate purity of the Svabhavakaya. The adventitious purity, adventitious means acquired. So this is the condition of having abandoned the two types of obscuration, the obscurations to liberation, and the obscurations to omniscience. So this emptiness is acquired through application of the true path. And progressively, the mind becomes empty of the gross afflictions, of the medium afflictions, and the subtle afflictions, and then the gross obscurations to omniscience, medium, and subtle. So this is the purity now of a Buddhist mind, empty of those afflictions. So that's what the nature body, Svabhavakaya, refers to. The Dharmakaya is the immutable, omniscient mind of Buddhahood, the wisdom. So, in the death process, we mentioned the wisdom Buddhas, Varachana, Ratnasambhava, and so on, which represent the perfection of the ordinary types of wisdom that we all possess, or knowledge that we all possess now. So, the first of these wisdoms is called the mirror-like wisdom, represented by the Buddha Varachana. So this is achieved, this perfection of this wisdom is achieved by keeping the Dharma properly, by serving one's guru, listening, thinking, and meditating on the teachings, and then eventually abandoning the two obscurations. So there are points there about the mirror-like wisdom, which you can read. Then the Dharmakaya has the wisdom of sameness or equality, symbolized by yellow Ratnasambhava. So this wisdom evolves from the realization achieved by Bodhisattva while still on the path, that his own condition and the condition of others is the same. So remember, equalizing and exchanging self with others is the most powerful way to develop bodhicitta, as we talk about on Wednesday nights. Equalizing means seeing the essence of equalizing is seeing others as equal to oneself, the same as oneself, not different. Not the same that we're one, but all of our minds function in a similar way. And the description of the afflictions and how they affect our minds and how we react works for each one of us. So, as we recognize our own suffering, as we recognize our own happiness and unhappiness, then we understand that every other individual has exactly the same experience as we do. And as they want happiness, I want happiness. I'm only one. They are uncountable. their happiness is more important than mine. Yeah. One, compared to uncountable numbers. So, our big problem is that all our life we've considered my happiness to be more important than others. And so we've focused mainly on ourselves, self-cherishing, and put others second. Yeah, we do help others, but the priority is number one. The wisdom of sameness. This wisdom enables us to generate bodhicitta by equalizing self and others. Okay, there's information there on the notes. The wisdom of discernment, symbolized by Amitabha. So this is the perfection of the ordinary mental consciousness that identifies, can discern or distinguish between different entities such as blue, yellow, and so on. So when perfected, this wisdom has no obstruction to recognizing the general and the specific properties of everything that exists and is achieved by teaching Dhamma correctly. The next wisdom, the wisdom of accomplishment, represented by Amoghasiddhi, is the knowledge that is able to accomplish the welfare of others. And so the perfection of this wisdom is the ability to send many emanation forms of a Buddha, to send emanations throughout the universe to work for individuals according to their specific needs. Final wisdom, the wisdom of Dhammadhatu, represented by Akshobhya, knows the two levels of truth about everything. So the Dhammakaya can be looked at in these five types of wisdom. And that is the omniscient wisdom of Buddhahood. And, you know, it is actually the perfection of knowledge that we already have. It is not something new to be acquired, it is what we have to be perfected. Now, the physical side of the body, the two kayas of the Buddha's body, there's the Sambhogakaya, or the enjoyment body. So the Sambhogakaya is called the enjoyment body because there's their enjoyment of the Mahayana Dhamma. It's the ultimate physical body, in that upon achieving Buddhahood, instantaneously one's body becomes Sambhogakaya in one's pure realm, all created through the accumulation of merit through bodhicitta. So effortlessly, the Sambhogakaya reveals manifestations, it speaks the Dhamma, and performs the Buddha's mental activities uninterruptedly. There are five certainties. The location is always at the level of the Akanishta Pure Land. The retinue, Sambhogakaya, is always surrounded by Arya Bodhisattvas. The physical attributes, it always has the 32 major signs and the 8 minor marks. It only teaches the Mahayana Dhamma. And the duration, it remains until the end of samsara. The emanation body, the fourth kaya, is emanations of the Sambhogakaya, which act extensively throughout the universe, appearing in all forms to aid sentient beings. So that is Buddhahood, the valid object of refuge. Now, the final topic that I wanted to talk about today is the 37 factors conducive to enlightenment. When we take the 8 Mahayana precepts, we mention, you know, wishing to achieve the 37 factors conducive to enlightenment. So in terms of the name, the 37 factors are common to the practice of hearers, of solitary realizers and bodhisattvas. The names of these 37 are the same, but in terms of the scope and the procedure of practicing them, there is a difference. The bodhisattva's practice of 37 factors is much more vast than the hearers and solitary realizers. So the first four of these are the four establishments in mindfulness. If you have studied the presentation of the various schools of Buddhist philosophy, then and the paths, they call salam, paths and grounds, then you know that there are three levels of practitioner: the two Hinayana practitioners, hearers, solitary realizers, and the Mahayana practitioner, the Bodhisattva. So their paths consist of five levels: the path of accumulation, path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, and the path of no more learning. So there are these fives for each of these levels, and again the five vary somewhat in their scope and their attainment. So each of these 37 factors is mentioned in the notes at which levels of those paths are attained. I won't repeat them, you can read them. So the four foundations or establishments of mindfulness are meditating on the body, on feelings, on mind, and the other internal phenomena, the other remaining mental factors, and those impermanent things which are neither mind nor form. So, mindfulness on the body is to be aware that our body is impure in nature, it's a true suffering, and through this meditation we overcome attachment to the body and the sense of renunciation, wishing to separate from the body. Meditating on our feelings, happiness, unhappiness, neutral feeling, we realize that all of our feelings are a different type of suffering. Even our happiness is a type of suffering, because mundane happiness depends upon mundane objects, products of karma and afflictions. And there is inevitable disappointment. The sensory objects we depend upon for pleasure, they wear out, they get lost, they die. So the objects deteriorate, and the subject, the mind, deteriorates. We become bored. We become dissatisfied. We always want more. The more sensory pleasure we have, the more we want. There's no sensory pleasure where we experience, oh, that was good, and I don't want to have it ever again. Of course we do. We can't help. We want to. So that's suffering. And then when we can't get it again, we start craving from the memories. Oh, it was so good. Well, I wish I could happen it again. But it doesn't happen. So feelings are all unsatisfactory, even our happiness. And we think about the emptiness of the objects of feelings, and we realize that through pleasure and pain, we develop attachment and aversion, and we create negative karma. So it means that being mindful of the body and the feelings is 24 hours a day. We should be aware of what our body is doing, and it may be hungry or it hurts. We stub our toe and it hurts. That's the nature of the body. If it meets an unpleasant object, it hurts. And then we get on with it. Of course, we avoid pain, but pain always comes, we want it or not. You know, we get sick, have an accident. Yes, this is the nature of the body. And so the body is an impermanent, true suffering. Of course I'm getting sick. Of course I've got cancer. Of course I'm going to die. This body cannot last much longer. That knowledge, that awareness, gives such power to remain calm and equilibrium when physical adversity happens, as it will. Feelings, happiness, that we're aware that, yeah, I'm experiencing this pleasure because I created virtue. I created good karma, probably in a past life. This is a result of positive karma. But if I get attached to it, then I'll push it away. I won't experience the happiness anymore. So we just acknowledge that this is a result of virtue. And when pain occurs, we acknowledge this is a result of non-virtue, being aware of karmic cause and effect. And we don't get angry. This is the thing about being mindful all the time. Body, feeling, and mind. The six types of consciousness, six main types of consciousness. So, we remember they're impermanent. That the continuum of any mental experience doesn't... It goes on forever. There's no self separate from the mind. There's no self the same as the mind. And the mind is always running after pleasure, running away from pain, active, worried, etc. But those are all superficial disturbances in the mind, the main consciousness. When they stop, like when we're watching our breath, the nature of the mind is peaceful. So mindfulness of the main consciousness keeps us aware of nirvana, the true peace of nirvana and the great bliss of enlightenment. The fourth foundation of mindfulness, other internal phenomena, is all of the other emotions, the constructive emotions of patience, love, wisdom, compassion, and the destructive emotions, pride, jealousy, anger, and so on. And the other aspects of, you know, the 51 mental factors, or 50, because feeling is one, so we've taken that out. So, by watching our emotions, then the positive ones bring happiness, peace, and we understand that's what is to be cultivated. The negative ones, longing, desire, jealousy, pride, anger, that is what is I need to abandon. So in some ways, it's good to get agitated and to recognize it. Oh, I'm getting upset. Oh, good. Now I can see my problem. Of course, somebody's upsetting me, but that person is not my problem. My problem is the upset mind. Irritated. This is the fuel of anger. And anger we definitely know is no good. So by being mindful of the thought activity, where's my daydream going? I'm supposed to be washing my breath, but the mind has gone off into a fantasy of beautiful food or, you know, any physical indulgence in pleasure. It won't stay. That's my problem. So we recognize this. These foundations of mindfulness are alert, so we know what, by recognizing our problem, we've received the Buddha's teachings to know what to do about them. So those are the four, the 37 factors. The four effortful abandonments are the next. So from the beginners striving to abandon desire, up to the striving of a 10th ground bodhisattva to remove the final obscuration to Buddhahood. So effortful abandonment refers to effort to overcome obstacles to meditation. And the obstacles are excitement and laxity. Right? Excitement means we're trying to meditate, the mind's going off on a fantasy of desire. Laxity, the mind's becoming dull. And the object, we're holding the object, it's not clear. It's not crystal clear. Laxity. And that can go into sleep. You can actually drop off to sleep on your, sitting on your meditation cushion. So, abandoning those, you can read. It gives us effort. The effort refers to not cultivating or generating afflictions which haven't yet manifested, and the effort to abandon afflictions when they do manifest. When there is, we recognize that there's agitation or anger in the mind, immediately drop it. Apply the antidote. Or jealousy, or attachment. Drop it. That's the effort. The effort to generate the pure, the virtue, not yet generated, to really train the mind in love, compassion. And finally, effort to increase pure phenomena, love, compassion, wisdom, that have already been generated but need to be strengthened. The next four are the four supports, or the four legs of miraculous manifestation. So these are the powers for attaining single point of concentration, which becomes the basis for clairvoyant powers. So clairvoyant powers are very useful for enhancing our practice of Dharma. So there are many things we can do in a constructive manner. Clairvoyant powers of knowing others' minds and so on. So to achieve that level of concentration, we need strong aspiration to create virtue, constant effort in performing virtue. We need prior cultivation of single point of concentration and the discriminating wisdom of knowing what to do through receiving instructions on how to meditate. So clairvoyant powers in themselves can be achieved by anybody. You don't have to be a Buddhist. The foundation is single point of concentration. So you don't have to be a Buddhist to achieve that. But from the Buddhist point of view, and it is very useful to have these psychological powers to strongly enhance our practice, especially the practice for others. The next two groups of five, there's five faculties and five powers. So they have the same names, but the second group is much stronger. So these are faculties or powers to practice virtue. The states of mind that focus on the Four Noble Truths. The first is faith. So we've already talked about faith. In particular, there's faith with respect to what is to be adopted or discarded from among the Four Noble Truths. Right? So the Four Noble Truths. The first two, true suffering and true origin of suffering, are to be discarded. And the second two, the cessation of suffering and the true path to that cessation, is to be adopted. Joyful effort is enthusiasm for this adopting and discarding what's appropriate. So joyful effort complements, enhances our faith. Without joyful effort, we won't apply ourselves to overcoming karma and afflictions. Right? It takes joyful effort. Doing the prostrations, reciting the Vajrasattva mantra, studying, the activities of studying, thinking, and meditating, you know, practicing Dharma, we have faith, but if we don't have this joy and joyful effort, our faith won't advance us towards wisdom. So the third is mindfulness, not forgetting, remembering what I need to adopt, what I need to discard. And this will lead to meditative stabilization, concentration, single-pointed concentration, knowing what to adopt, what to abandon. And eventually, that leads to wisdom. The wisdom derived from meditation and the wisdom knowing the most skillful way to act in life. So these five faculties, you can see how to, this is how to practice Dharma. And again, it comes back to the simple presentation, the practicing of Dharma is abandoning from our mind what needs to be abandoned and cultivating what needs to be cultivated. That's all. That is the object of practicing Dharma. We keep coming back to this. Now you know how to do it. The five powers are similar words, but much stronger. They attain higher levels of the path. So, faith in this context refers to refuge in the three jewels, with a special intention to save all beings by attaining Buddhahood. So this is the Bodhisattva's refuge. Remember at the very beginning I said the three levels of refuge, the refuge of in three jewels as the foundation of avoiding rebirth in one of the three lower realms. Refuge in the three jewels as a foundation for avoiding attachment to higher rebirth and achieving nirvana. And then the Bodhisattva's refuge in the three jewels to save all sentient beings. So the fear is not for oneself. The fear is for the suffering of others to achieve Buddhahood. So that's the Bodhisattva's faith. So these five powers, as they're described here, are unique to the Mahayana. So this joyful effort in practicing the six perfections with that refuge goal. Perfections of generosity, of patience, of morality, enthusiasm, concentration, and wisdom. Then this mindfulness is never forgetting the altruistic intention to become enlightened. And then meditative stabilization and wisdom. All right. So you can see that there are the same words, faith, joyful effort, mindfulness, etc., but the explanation of what they are is quite different. And the second part is talking about the Bodhisattva's path. The seven branches of enlightenment, again, mindfulness, discrimination of phenomena, effort, joy, pliancy, stabilization, and equanimity. So these are mental qualities achieved in meditation. They're not only achieved, like here it says, they're achieved on the path of seeing, but of course, one trains in those qualities prior to the path of seeing. Here they're perfected. So they lead to the Eightfold Noble Path, attained with the path of meditation, but practiced by all beings, all Buddhists. The correct views, which oppose the five main wrong views, correct realization, seeing and teaching subtle emptiness, correct speech, vows and teaching emptiness without contradiction, correct aims of actions, following vows, correct livelihood, correct effort to abandon the afflictions, correct mindfulness on objects and modes of perception necessary for attaining the paths, and correct meditative stabilization on the objects of the power. So that completes the 37 factors conducive to enlightenment. So we've just listed these, but you can see that this is common to all practitioners, and you can see what it means to practice Dharma and achieve your goal of enlightenment. It all comes down to a common, similar presentation. And the more we think about it, the simpler the path appears to our minds. Of course, doing it, it takes time, the joyful effort. But as Pabong Rinpoche said, even though it might take the Bodhisattva three countless great eons from generating bodhicitta to enlightenment, it takes longer than that to get out of the three lower realms. We have come from the three lower realms. We have already been practicing for more than three countless great eons to get out of the three lower realms by achieving this perfect human rebirth. We're more than halfway there. And that's true. What a tragedy if we were to give up, to give in to self-centeredness, self-cherishing, and waste this perfect opportunity to practice Dharma. Tragedy is that we're going to fall back again to the three lower realms. And it's almost as if we'll never get out. You know, three countless great eons is a terrible time. In the Aryasagata Sutra, Buddha tries to give it. He's asked to give an analogy for the duration of one eon of time. And if you've read it, it is beyond comprehension. One eon, not to mention three countless great eons. Yes, even if we do fall back, eventually we will get out. But we should not. But the point is, don't be put off by thinking the Dharma practice is only for those special ones, those bodhisattvas, those who can do it. I can't. We can. We must enthuse ourselves with energy and recognition that we can do it. And we must do it whilst we're still alive. The chance may not be here for much longer. So we have, in this short talks today, we began with the foundations of taking refuge, fear and faith, and then recognition of the qualities of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So in that we get an understanding of the goal, one's own Buddhahood for the benefit of others. And then we've thought a little bit about the four kayas, the body and mind of Buddhahood, attainable. They are just the perfection of what we already have. And the means, the factors conducive to enlightenment, or the legs to achieving our potential of Buddhahood, are these 37 points that we've talked about. And they are not philosophically difficult to understand. They're quite logical. And it's very clear. So, it's up to us. Nobody can change our mind. Not even Buddha can change our mind. The only person who can change our mind is ourself. Right? We're the only ones who have access to our mind, and therefore we're the ones, it's our responsibility, knowing how to practice Dharma and knowing the great debt that we owe to each other, then for the benefit of others, we should generate the strong, enthusiastic determination to achieve our full potential and train our mind in the path. So in this subject, we have covered the whole spectrum of Buddha's teachings. I'd be very happy if I were teaching from personal experience, but I'm just teaching from what I've been taught. I'm repeating what I've read and what I've heard. But what appeals to me, I've tried to share my personal feelings and experience and enthusiasm for the Dharma. And the more we can make a connection with a qualified Dharma teacher, and the more we can please the teacher, then the better and better our lives will be. And remember, the meaning of pleasing the teacher is not gifts or any external display, it's the internal practice of Dharma. That is the greatest offering that we can give to our teachers. It's not just thanking them for what they've done, but showing our recognition of the value of the present they have given to us. Yeah. Being mindful of that makes it certain, like tomorrow, I think it's Guru Puja, the Lama Chöpa Puja, is visualizing and remembering the qualities of the Guru, the Lama, and the lineage Lamas back to Shakyamuni Buddha. So the chanting is one thing, but the meaning, doing that puja, reflecting upon the meaning of appreciation, of the kindness and the energy that the whole lineage lamas have put into maintaining the unbroken lineage of Buddha's teachings up until this day and age, to our own meditation room. It's been established by the kindness of so many people who have been inspired by the teachings. Then, so there's the lamas, there's the founders of the center, the benefactors, all have come together for us. So how fortunate we are to be able to repay the kindness. So let's dedicate the accumulated positive energy of this discussion on refuge to all sentient beings, by sincerely in our hearts generating the firm intention that through this merit I shall attain Buddhahood in order to repay the kindness of all mother sentient beings. Thank you so much.